This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. No one more so than Bill McKibben, who has honored us with his presence. I, Paula, Bill Russell. 350. This is a very big idea that I need enough background to tell me what the 350 gets me to.
Okay. Let's do math for a minute.
Oh, let's do arithmetic.
Just a little bit.
Just arithmetic.
Arithmetic.
Okay.
That's all you gotta do. No, there's no multiplication here. Just simple addition.
I can do that.
Before people started burning coal and gas and oil, before the Industrial Revolution, the atmosphere had 275 parts per million carbon dioxide. That was a good number. It produced the temperate planet that we were used to.
And it had been there for a long, long time.
And that carbon dioxide, you know, keeps some of the sun's heat here close to the planet. It serves like a pane of glass on a greenhouse. Well, once we start burning coal and gas and oil, all that coal and gas and oil has carbon dioxide in it, quite a bit. I mean, you burn a gallon of gasoline to power your lawnmower, and that gallon of gasoline, which weighs 8 pounds, produces about 5.5 pounds of carbon in the form of CO2. And it's not pollution like we're used to thinking. That's just natural, normal byproduct of combustion. So the atmosphere begins to fill with more carbon dioxide, more and more and more, a little bit each year. By now, we're up to 385 parts per million carbon dioxide. Too much, as it turns out. Hence, melting Arctic ice. Hence, big changes in flood and drought as warm air takes up more water vapor. Hence, sea levels threatening to rise precipitously. Hence, mosquitoes spreading. Hence, many, many, many things. The scientists now tell us, within the last year really, that the new sort of magic number is 350. We've got to cut down a lot on our burning of coal and gas and oil so that the Earth can start to process that carbon and reduce the amount in the atmosphere back down to at least 350 parts per million, no more than that.
And we're already at 385.
We're already too far. It's just like we've gone to the doctor, and the doctor has said, your cholesterol is too high, Paul. Sorry to tell you this, but, you know, there's no more cheese in your future. You got to...
And this from a guy from Vermont.
You got to eat right. You got to eat right so that your cholesterol will come back down. Your body can do it, but it can't do it if you keep feeding it cheese. You know, that you can't overcome it, but if you stop, it'll cleanse it out. Same with the Earth, except instead of cheese, coal. You know, we've got it.
And oil.
We're gonna burn most of the oil that's out there. And it's so valuable, and we're so that it's almost a fruitless task to try to really imagine not burning. We've already burned most of the oil that we have. There's not that much left. We're past the halfway point. Coal, we've got lots and lots of. And if we burn most of it, forget it. So that's the new task that we've been given. And it's a very immediate task and a very tough one. And we're now trying to spread the word about it. We've started this group, 350.org, 350.org. And we're getting people all around the world to figure out ways to tell their neighbors about that number. We've got to make that number tattoo it into everybody's brain, so that they know that that's the number on this world that represents safety. And if we do that, if we can do that education quickly, then there's some hope that when the world's diplomats meet to finally hammer out the treaty about climate change that's coming in the next 3 or 4 years, under the next U.S. president probably, then there's some chance they'll do the right thing.
We're already in danger.
We're out of the safe zone. We're into the danger zone. We got to scramble back. That's the task for civilization in the 21st century, to scramble back to something that resembles safety.
And if we don't do it in the next 5, 6, 7 years...
It gets unbelievably hard. It gets harder and harder each year that we put it off. And the reason it gets harder is because as it gets warmer, the Earth begins to take over this process, and you get these positive, what scientists would call positive feedback effects. So, you melt all that ice on the top of the Arctic. One of the things that happens is you've taken away this nice white mirror. Right now, with ice, the sun's rays come in, they hit that white ice, 80% of them bounce back out to space, harmlessly. You replace it with blue water, that sun comes in, 80% of it's absorbed by that blue water, and it heats it up more, and the whole process gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And there's all kinds of feedback loops like that. You start melting tundra in the Arctic, the permafrost there. Turns out there's a lot of methane, another potent global warming gas, stored underneath that permafrost. There have been places in the last few winters in Russia and Siberia, in the coldest place on Earth, where there's so much methane coming up out of the ground that ponds and lakes never freeze over, even in the coldest part of winter. It's like a bubbler, like a fountain, keeping that that ice from ever freezing, all that methane coming out into the atmosphere. Those are scary signs that we've gotten very, very close to the edge. There are people who tell you, scientists who tell you, we've gone over the edge. The best science tells us we may still have a window open, but not a really big window, and it's closing pretty fast, so we darn well better get to work.
Something about an incentive here.
When you talk about positive feedback, that sounds arcane. What that means is these are highly nonlinear systems, which also sounds arcane. But what that means, I mean, we think of this as a slope. You know, it just gets a little worse each year, and it happens incrementally. And as you know, when the wave shows up, then we'll build a dike or something. But it's, you know, but these are highly nonlinear. It won't happen. It is not gradual.
Let's compare it with sort of other bad political problems that we have, okay? Healthcare. You know, we've spent a long time having all kinds of people without health insurance so they can't take care of themselves, okay? That's terrible. It's unacceptable in a rich country that we're the only industrialized nation that can't seem to provide healthcare to all its people. But from year to year, people suffer as a result of this, but it doesn't become exponentially harder to deal with. If you put it off for 20 years, like we've done since, you know, the first Clinton administration, when we pretty much screwed up the whole process and never got back to it, if you put it off, it's not like it's now 100 times harder to deal with. It's still pretty much the same problem. You've just delayed dealing with it until people have suffered in the meantime. This isn't like that. If you every year that you put this off, the physical forces behind it keep moving, and they move in such ways that it becomes harder and harder to deal with. So now you've got an unfrozen Arctic that's, you know, causing more warming, and you've got methane leaking up from the permafrost, and you've got a dozen other of these kind of feedback effects, and they're each one making it more and more difficult with each passing year. And yet we keep putting it off. And we keep putting it off because it's uncomfortable.
One of the things that I found really interesting in talking several years ago with David Suzuki was he said, I've been out here 40 years being Jeremiah, and nobody would listen to me. So, he said, I turned a corner, and I started talking about, and this was the name of a book, Good News for a Change.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, you've taken some of that path yourself when you came to mm-hmm. Deep Economy to say yes and, mm-hmm. not yes but, yes and. Mm-hmm. We've got to do it. We have to do it now. Paula, make sure that you have replaced your washer-dryer with what we have replaced it with, which is a washer-dryer, one instead of two, half as much to be built, uses $17 worth of energy in the course of the year instead of lots and lots and lots and lots of energy, smart thinking in terms of what you buy. And you talk about whole economies that
there's
we can...
whole ways we can get at this in... You know,
and we can do that. I can do
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Think about food, okay? Something that almost all of us consume on a daily basis. Right now, we've built this kind of... We think of it as normal, but viewed from a distance, if somebody came in a spaceship, they'd think it was kind of odd. The average bite of food that we eat has traveled 1,500 miles by the time it reaches our lips. It's essentially marinated in crude oil, you know? It's energy intensive. Not to mention that it doesn't really taste like anything, but I mean, I traveled 1,500 miles yesterday to get here, and I feel pretty limp. That's pretty much how the tomato feels, you know, and it gets here too.
Mm-hmm.
Let's contrast that with another system. In fact, now the fastest growing part of the food economy in America, the local farmers market. It's growing fast, still small, but growing fast.
And it's your favorite metaphor, because there are lots of ways that we can think about all kinds of things.
All sorts of things. You use less energy to eat locally, you get better food, but you also have a different experience. And that's the real kicker. You know, compare it with the supermarket. A couple years ago, a pair of sociologists followed shoppers. First around the supermarket, then around the farmer's market. You've been to the supermarket, you walk in, you fall into a light fluorescent trance, you visit the stations of the cross around the supermarket, you emerge with the same stuff you had the week before, that's it. Not a lot of drama or pleasure. When they followed shoppers around the farmer's market, they found that on average they had 10 times more conversations than they did when they went to the supermarket. It wasn't a different way of getting calories. It was a whole different human experience. In fact, one remarkably close to the way that humans have shopped for food in the 10,000 years that we've had agriculture, you know, so probably no wonder that it's kind of attractive to us. You can make the same argument with energy or with, you know, many, many other commodities.
And there's joy in that.
Well, think about even ephemeral commodities like music, okay? We're used to the idea that it's a product, too, like food that should come from a big distance and a central source. Some guy, some company in Hollywood or Nashville makes music, puts it in a hard-to-open plastic box, sends it to us, you know? That model is breaking down. People are using their computers to make sure it breaks down, but that doesn't mean that music's going to disappear. The fastest-growing part of the music industry is live performance, music festivals, traveling jam bands, you know, like Fish from my state of Vermont or, you know, whatever.
Because, and troubadours.
Exactly right. Troubadours is the right word. Because people want not just to consume music, they want to consume it in the company of other people. They want that experience that makes it better. In fact, it's the perfect example of something that's better when it's shared than when it's kept to yourself.
We're going to share Bill McKibben with you when we come back in just a moment. Be with us when we return.